Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Hello, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 25th of May. We will continue listen to Master Tenzin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow, and please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and I'm glad you could join us today. I hope you'll find something of value in the program. Last week, we got into a consideration of the brain and how it functions, following on from a comment from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In his commentary to the text we're following, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, he said, "We need to examine things from our own experience and also take into consideration the modern scientific explanation of things in terms of the presentation of the brain, how it works through the senses, how different parts of the brain are involved with different mental functions, and so on. We need to try to understand how the mind works in terms of our own experience as well as in terms of the scientific explanation. This will definitely require a great deal of investigation." Expanding on this, I drew on an article from the National Geographic by Carl Zimmer titled Secrets of the Brain and dated in February last year. It looks a little at the world of neuroscience and what's going on in there. We quoted one experiment by Jeff Lichtman in which pieces of preserved mouse brain were very thinly sliced, photographed through an electron microscope, and then stacked into the three-dimensional image. From that, the scientists tried to map all the neurons in a section about 1/100th the size of a grain of salt. If you were with us, you may remember how the article continued. That minuscule patch of brain turned out to be like a barrel of seething snakes. Kashuri found 1,000 axons and about 80 dendrites, each making about 600 connections with other neurons inside the cylinder. It's a wake-up call to how much more complicated brains are than the way we think about them, says Lichtman. The scientists found that every neuron made nearly all its connections with just one other. They seemed to care who they connected to, was Lichtman's conclusion, though whether the finding pointed to a general rule or something unique to the minute area of brain sampled, only time and more intricate experimentation will tell. And this is only one bit of research in an article that looks at many. Because His Holiness says that this kind of research is important for us to understand the mind, and because it's very interesting, I'd like to take a little time to go further into the article. But before we do that, let's set our motivation for participating in the program today, particularly thinking about bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings everywhere. This is best, but if you can't go quite that far, please motivate for your own enlightenment and freedom from suffering, and not for some lesser goal. Thank you. Now, the result of another bit of work on the brain cited by Carl Zimmer is the Allen Brain Atlas, constructed by the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. This institute was, incidentally, founded a decade ago with money from Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. Whether that makes it an honorable enterprise or not, I'm not qualified to venture into. In any case, researchers at the university used MRI scans of the brains of newly dead people as a three-dimensional roadmap, which they sliced very thinly and mounted on glass slides. They then doused them with chemicals to uncover active genes in the neurons. The article continues, "So far, the researchers have mapped the brains of 6 people, charting the activity of 20,000 protein-coding genes at 700 sites within each brain. It's a colossal amount of data, and they've only begun to make sense of it. The scientists estimate that 84% of all the genes in our DNA become active somewhere in the adult brain. A simpler organ like the heart or pancreas requires far fewer genes to work. In each of the 700 sites the scientists studied, the neurons switch on a distinct collection of genes. In a preliminary survey of two regions of the brain, the scientists compared 1,000 genes that were already known to be important for neuron function. From one person to the next, the areas of the brain where each of those genes was active were practically identical. It looks as if the brain is a finely grained genetic landscape with special combinations of genes carrying out tasks in different locations. The secret to many diseases of the brain may be hiding in that landscape as certain genes shut down or switch on abnormally. Some Brazilian scientists have used the data in the study of Fowler's disease, which calcifies regions deep inside the brain, leading to dementia. The disease had already been linked to a mutation in a particular gene, and the atlas confirmed that particular gene is most active in regions targeted by the disease. But the scientists also found that other genes were also most active in the same areas, and now they're trying to see if those other genes are also involved in Fowler's disease. But in his article, Zimmer says the most remarkable of all the new ways of visualizing the brain was invented by Stanford neuroscientist and psychiatrist Carl Dieseroth and his colleagues. To see the brain, they begin by making it disappear. Zimmer writes, "On my visit to Dieseroth's lab, undergraduate Janelle Wallace led me to a bench where half a dozen beakers rested in a plastic foam base. She pulled one out and pointed to a grape-sized mouse brain resting at the bottom. I didn't look at the brain so much as through it. It was nearly as transparent as a glass marble." Needless to say, a normal human or mouse brain is decidedly opaque, its cells swathed in fat and other compounds that block light. The advantage of a transparent brain is that it allows us to peer into its workings while the organ is still intact. Along with postdoctoral researcher Kwang Hung Chung, Dieseroth came up with a recipe to replace the light-scattering compounds in the brain with transparent molecules. After making a mouse brain transparent in this way, they can then douse the brain with glowing chemicals. It's not easy to dazzle neuroscientists, but Dieseroth's method, dubbed clarity, has left his colleagues awestruck. "It's pretty badass," says Christoph Koch, the chief scientific officer at the location of just one type of protein in just one human brain would create a monstrous heap of data, about 2 petabytes, or the equivalent of several 100,000 high-def movies. Dieseroth anticipates the clarity may someday help the sort of people he treats in his psychiatry practice by revealing hidden features of disorders like autism and depression. But for now, he's keeping those hopes in check. "We have so far to go before we can affect treatments that I tell people don't even think about that yet," he says. "It's just a voyage of discovery for now." A transparent brain may reveal a great deal, but it will still be dead, and scientists need other ways to explore living brains, which they do with scanners and functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. Zimmer writes, "Over the past couple of decades, fMRI has helped reveal networks involved in all manner of thought processes, from recognizing faces to enjoying a cup of coffee to remembering a traumatic event." But he concedes that the images are still relatively coarse, leading Clay Reed of the Allen Institute to admit there are ridiculously simple questions about the cortex that we can't answer at all. Reed and other researchers are in Seattle working on a project called MindScope, aimed at understanding how a mass of neurons carries out a complex task. They are using vision as a basis for their study. Scientists have been investigating how we see for decades, but they've been able to study it only piecemeal, writes Zimmer. A neuroscientist might place an electrode in the region of a mouse's brain involved in visual perception and then note whether nearby neurons fire when the animal sees a particular image. This approach has allowed scientists to map regions of the visual brain that specialize in different tasks, such as detecting the edges of an object or perceiving brightness. But scientists haven't been able to see all those regions work together at once. To learn how the million or so neurons in the visual regions of a mouse brain instantly put information together into the image of a cat. Reed and his colleagues are setting out to solve that problem by engineering mice so that their visual neurons will release flashes of light when they fire. The flashes record the neural activity when a mouse sees a specific object, be it a cat, a snake, or an appealing piece of cheese. The scientists can then compile the data to create massive mathematical volumes of vision. If the models are accurate, the researchers will be able to literally read the mind of a mouse. Our goal is to reconstruct what the mouse sees, says Reed, and I think we can do it. Yet another line of research in the quest for a comprehensive understanding of the brain involves brain-machine interfaces, and this is where the research is changing people's lives. The article continues, when she was 43 years old, Kathy Hutchinson suffered a massive stroke, leaving her unable to move or speak. Lying in her bed in Massachusetts General Hospital, she gradually figured out that her doctors didn't know if she was brain dead or still aware. Her sister asked Hutchinson if she could understand her. She managed to answer by moving her eyes up on command. It gave me such a relief, Hutchinson tells me 17 years later, because everybody talked about me as if I was dying. It's a chilly winter day at her home in eastern Massachusetts, and she's sitting in a wheelchair in the middle of the living room, dressed in a dark green jogging suit and sneakers. Still almost completely paralyzed and unable to speak, she communicates by looking at letters arrayed on a computer monitor bolted to her wheelchair. A camera tracking the movement of a tiny metal disc attached to the center of her eyeglasses. Near the top of the brain is a region called the motor cortex, where we generate commands to move our muscles. For more than a century, we've known that each part of the cortex corresponds to a particular area of the body. When people like Hutchinson become paralyzed, the motor cortex often remains intact, but it can't communicate with the rest of the body because its connections have been destroyed. John Donahue, a neuroscientist at Brown University, wanted to find a way to help people with paralysis by tapping into the signals from their motor cortex. Perhaps they could eventually learn to type on a computer or operate a machine merely with their thoughts. Donahue spent years developing an implant and testing the device on monkeys. Once he and his colleagues knew it was safe, they were ready to start working with human patients. One of them was Hutchinson. In 2005, surgeons at Rhode Island Hospital drilled a hole the size of a poker chip in her skull and inserted a sensor for Donahue's device. About the size of a ladybug, the sensor contained 100 miniature needles, which, pressing into Hutchinson's motor cortex, recorded the signals from nearby neurons. A set of wires anchored to this device passed through the hole in her skull and led to a metal connector sitting on her scalp. After her surgery had healed, the Brown University researchers plugged Hutchinson's implant into a cable that relayed signal patterns from her brain to a cart of computers they wheeled into her room. As a first step, the scientists trained the computers to recognize signals in her motor cortex and use them to move a computer cursor around a screen. This was achieved the first time she tried, because they had learned how to translate patterns of brain activity into movements. 2 years later, they coupled a robotic arm to the computers, refining a program that could interpret Hutchinson's brain signals to move the arm forward and back, to raise it up and down and to open its robotic fingers and squeeze them shut. After a few sessions, Hutchinson, the computer, and the robotic arm had become a team. It felt natural, she tells me. So natural that one day she reached out for a cinnamon latte, grabbed it, and brought it to her lips to drink. Kathy's smile when she put down that drink, that's everything, Donahue says. While he and other scientists are continuing to develop their work, at Duke University, Miguel Nicolelis has been experimenting with exoskeletons that strap onto the body. He has already got signals from the brains of monkeys to control each limb of full-body exoskeletons. Eventually, brain implants will become as common as heart implants, says Nicolelis. I have no doubt about that. His Holiness the Dalai Lama takes speculation about the workings of the brain out into more metaphysical realms. He wonders what part the brain plays in extrasensory perception, such as perceiving what might happen in the future, which comes from gaining absorbed concentration. He says such things are explained in the scriptures, and there are actually people who develop it. A mental continuum that has experienced something that has happened previously is able to have some warnings of what will occur later, but only if that continuum has some interdependent relationship with the two events. It is possible to develop clairvoyance and give certain predictions of the future, but if there's no relationship of a future event with a continuity of consciousness, then one is not able to guess even a hint of the future. Clairvoyance doesn't arise from nowhere. It is based on the various causes and circumstances in the actual mental continuum of the individual who has it. Now, if you Google clairvoyance in the brain, you get quite an array of articles and books, many seeming quite reputable, about the role the brain plays in extrasensory perceptions like clairvoyance. The Daily Mail ran an article in 2007 about some of the research going on in this area and found that most of us have some ability to predict the future. It quotes the psychologist Professor Dick Bierman of the University of Amsterdam, who scanned brains during paranormal experiments to see whether or not it is possible to predict the future. We are satisfied that people can sense the future before it happens, reported the professor. We'd now like to move on and see what kind of person is particularly good at it. And Bierman is not alone, says the article. His findings mirror the data gathered by other scientists and paranormal researchers both here and abroad. Professor Brian Josephson, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist from Cambridge University, says, so far, the evidence seems compelling. What seems to be happening is that information is coming from the future. In fact, it's not clear in physics why you can't see the future. In physics, you certainly cannot completely rule out this effect. The article goes on to cite a variety of examples of people seeming to get premonitions of future events. Some people survived the 9/11 disasters by changing their plans at the last moment due to some subtle, gnawing feeling that something was not right. One was a woman who, while queuing for one of the planes that crashed into the World Trade Center, got such stomach cramps that she had to rush to the toilet. She made her way to the lavatory only to recover spontaneously, says the article. She missed her flight, but survived the day. Amid the collective outpouring of grief and horror, it was easy to overlook such stories or to write them off as coincidences. But in fact, these kinds of stories point to an interesting and deeper truth for those willing to look. If, for example, fewer people decided to fly on an aircraft that subsequently crashed, then that would suggest a subconscious ability to divine the future. Well, strange as it seems, that's just what happens. The aircraft which flew into the Twin Towers on 9/11 were unusually empty. All the hijacked planes were carrying only half the usual number of passengers. Perhaps one unusually empty plane could be explained away, but all four? And it wasn't just on 9/11 that people subconsciously seemed to avoid disaster. The scientist Ed Cox found that trains destined to crash carried far fewer people than they normally did. Dr. Jessica Utz, a statistician at the University of California, found exactly the same bizarre effect. If it was possible to divine the future, you might expect those at the sharp end, such as pilots, to have the most finely tuned instincts of all. And again, that's just what you see. When the Air France Concorde crashed in 2000, it wasn't long before the colleagues of those killed in the crash spoke about a sense of foreboding that had gripped the crew and flight engineers before the accident. Speaking anonymously to the French newspaper Le Parisien, one spoke of a morbid expectation of an accident. "I had this sense that we were going to bump into the scenery," he said. "The atmosphere on the Concorde team for the last few months, if one has the guts to admit it, as were being one of morbid expectation of an accident. It was as if I was waiting for something to happen." All of these stories suggest that we can pick up premonitions of events that are yet to be. Well, these premonitions are not in glorious technicolor, they are often emotionally powerful enough for us to act upon them. In technical parlance, it is known as presentiment, because emotional feelings are being received from the future, not hard facts or information. The U.S. military, and latterly the CIA, have also got into the act with a program known as Stargate, which investigates premonitions and the ability of mediums to predict the future. Dr. Dean Radden worked on the Stargate program and became fascinated by lucky soldiers who survived battles against seemingly impossible odds. He became convinced that thoughts and feelings, and occasionally actual glimpses of the future, could flow backwards in time to guide soldiers and help them make life-saving decisions, often on the basis of a hunch. The article states, he devised an experiment to test these ideas. He hooked up volunteers to a modified lie detector, which measured an electrical current across the surface of the skin. This current changes when a person reacts to an event, such as seeing an extremely violent picture or video. It's the electrical equivalent of a wince. Radden showed sexually explicit, violent, or soothing images to volunteers in a random sequence determined by a computer. And he soon discovered that people began reacting to the pictures before they saw them. It was unmistakable. They began to wince a few seconds before they actually saw the image. And it happened time and time again, way beyond what chance alone would allow. So impressive were Radden's results that Dr. Carrie Mullis, a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, took an interest. He was hooked up to Radden's machine and showed the emotionally charged images. "It's spooky," he says. "I could see about 3 seconds into the future. You shouldn't be able to do that." Other researchers from around the world, from Edinburgh University to Cornell in the US, rushed to duplicate Radden's experiment and improve on it. And they got similar results. It was soon discovered that gamblers began reacting subconsciously shortly before they won or lost. The same effect was seen in those terrified of animals moments before they were shown the creatures. The odds against all of these trials being wrong are literally millions to one against. Professor Dick Bierman repeated Dr. Radden's experiments on volunteers wired up to an MRI scanner. His experiments involved over 20 volunteers, and he ran them twice, even though each analysis took weeks of computing time. The results, states the article, suggest quite clearly that seemingly ordinary people are capable of sensing the future on a fairly consistent basis. Bierman emphasizes that people are receiving feelings from the future rather than specific visions. It's clear, though, that if ordinary people can receive feelings from the future, then perhaps the especially gifted may receive visions of things yet to be. It's also clear that many paranormal phenomena, such as ESP and clairvoyance, could have their roots in presentiment. After all, if you can see a few seconds into the future, why not a few days or even years? And surely, if you could look through time, why not across great distances? It's a concept that ties the mind in knots, unless you're a physicist. "I believe that we can sense the future," says the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Brian Josephson. "We just haven't yet established the mechanism allowing it to happen." And whatever the mechanism for the everyday person's feelings from the future, as the article so quaintly puts it, In Buddhism, noticeable paranormal phenomena like clairvoyance are explained in terms either of karma from a previous life or advanced meditation. In the book Paranthropology, Anthropological Approaches to the Paranormal, edited by Jack Hunter, Dr. Serena Roni Dougal discusses her research with yogis and Tibetan Buddhists. She writes, "Tibetans distinguish two types of clairvoyance. They consider that the one Western parapsychologists research is a low-level ability that is unreliable and subject to fraud. Many people are considered to have this ability, and Tibetans consider that it is an inherent ability resulting from past life karma. The clairvoyance you attain as a result of meditation is considered to be a high-level ability which is absolutely reliable." She goes on to say that to develop such a reliable ability, the monk she spoke to claimed one had to have attained the highest one-pointed concentration, known as calm abiding, as well as vipassana, or special insight, and also one needs to overcome the obstacles presented by the desire realm. She writes, "So they reckon that reliable clairvoyance does not come easy. Only the very high lamas can manifest it with 100% reliability at will." In any case, she found that both the Buddhists and the yogis she spoke with claimed that calm abiding is essential for developing paranormal powers. Parapsychological research over the past 100 years suggests that psychic information is present at a subliminal level all the time, but normally it is only in specific circumstances that we become aware of this information. However, going into an altered state, such as dreaming or practicing meditation, increases the availability of this information in that we become more aware of the subtler aspects of our mind, she writes. In the previous program, we mentioned how the brains of meditation adepts tested by Dr. Davidson showed vastly different results in fMRI scans from those of non-meditators. So obviously, a sustained meditation practice has significant implications for changes in the brain. I don't know of any research into actual changes in the brain over the long period, sometimes over 40 years, a great meditator has practiced, but it seems fairly safe to say that such research would show some unusual brain transformations as a meditator becomes increasingly adept. And now I think we've delved enough into the functioning of the brain and its relation to mind and mind states. We might have lost the fact that this whole discussion came out of comments His Holiness the Dalai Lama made about what the Buddhist texts mean by beginningless time. In a concluding paragraph to that discussion, he continues, "The whole point of Buddha's teaching about beginningless time is that mind is beginningless. If he were not talking about the beginninglessness of mind, there would be not much point in his discussing beginninglessness in general. It's on the basis of beginningless mind that we get the discussion of the relation of mind to the body in terms of karma. Within the overall continuity of beginningless mind, various types of body come and go, both on an individual and a world level. The discussion of beginningless lifetimes and beginningless mind must be based on logic and reasoning, and it is something that can definitely be established in that way. So it's important to put a great deal of effort into investigating these points with logic." And now, we're back on the track of our discussion of Namkar Pal's text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. But we're going to have to leave it there until next week, as our time is now up. Thanks for joining the program today, and if you found it useful, please join us again next week. Kindly dedicate any positive potential we've created to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Have a wonderful week, and goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.